Paul Maroney is a urologic oncologist at the University of Colorado in Denver. He also runs the American Urological Association course on winning the battle against burnout. Paul is an extremely thoughtful and mindful surgeon, physician, and educator. In this episode of Operate with Zen, we tackle a lot more than burnout. We discuss extreme ownership of the good and bad that occurs in our surgical practices. We talk about putting successes and failures into perspective. And, in Paul's own words, we seek to find the joy in serving others. We would be lying if we said every day as a surgeon is amazingly positive, but every day can be amazing with the right perspective and approach. My name is Phil Perazio, and I'm a urologic oncologist, a surgeon. Like many of you, I absolutely love what I do, and I would not choose another profession. But I have struggled with professional identity, practice efficiency, and wellness over the years. Operate with Zen is a podcast designed to explore a mindful approach to surgery and to being a surgeon. By discussing these struggles and mindful solutions, I hope together we can create a community of strong and healthy surgeons. Enjoy. Welcome to this episode of Operate with Zen. Today, I've got the great pleasure of being visited and chatting with a good friend, Dr. Paul Maroney. Paul, introduce yourself to the audience.
Yeah, hi there. My name's Paul Maroney. I'm a urologic oncologist at the University of Colorado, and I'm the program leader of our urologic oncology clinic. And Phil, I'm really humbled by the invitation today to do this. I saw on Twitter last week you just passed 6,000 downloads of your podcast, and I'm pretty sure that you'll be hitting 60,000, you know, sometime in the next year. That'll be really cool. I think about the things that I've learned just paying attention to your podcast over the last year or so since it's been out, and things like the morning hydration I've picked up, that's helped out a lot. I've got my cup of water right here. You know, the belly breathing, it's helped me tolerate, you know, the traffic to and from work a bit. And then I do have to confess a little bit that when you invited me to do this, that I felt a little bit like, you know, I'm considered an expert in things like wellness, and I got a whole lot of imposter syndrome. You know, I don't really feel that so much as a surgeon anymore. But when you invited me to do this, and I've listened to all the great guests that you've had on this podcast, that I started to feel a little nervous about the idea that I'm some sort of expert in this, when I really feel like I kind of, you know, sort of was backing out of a parking space and, you know, knocked over a mailbox and a pot of gold fell out of it. I mean, it's a real nice invitation.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. And I'll tell you, you know, part of my personal journey, we first met a few years ago, and you just happened to be giving the burnout talk at the Mid-Atlantic meeting right when I was going through a terrible episode of burnout. And I don't know if you remember that conversation, but I do. And it was incredibly helpful to me, and you and others in the field have been a tremendous inspiration to me to kind of start this endeavor and help others. And I think that's why we talk about those things, is to help the other people out there, because what we went through was kind of miserable. And if we can even, you know, the hope would be to eliminate those things. I think that'll be hard, but if we could at least decrease the impact that those episodes have on people and their careers and their life and their loved ones, I think we're doing something in the right direction.
Yeah, and that means a lot to me. I absolutely remember that, because I've been sort of an admirer from academically from afar, and you've written a lot of papers that I kind of look at and it's like, geez, I wish I would have written a paper like that. And then when you come up to me after that and you say to me how much that you brought out of that. And I remember you came to the microphone and had a few, you know, germane questions I'm glad that you got a lot of value out of it. That's why I like to do these things.
Yeah. And just so the audience knows, you know, Paul runs the kind of burnout courses and curriculum for the AUA, and has done that for a number of years. But that's not exactly why we have you here, Paul. So, you know, if you don't mind, give us a little bit of your story and background, and we may talk about burnout a little bit, but there's so many other really exciting and important things that we want to talk about. So let's, we'll go from there.
Yeah. The, thing that really got me started on this was one of our residents during our grand rounds did the Maslach burnout inventory sort of in live action during the grand rounds. And the scores of our residents at that time were pretty bad. You know, a lot of our residents had a low sense of personal accomplishment. I got the sense that they really weren't enjoying their job. This really didn't kind of fit my memories of being a resident, because I was a resident at this same program. And I look back at residency, and you know, this is before work hours and things like that. So we were here a lot. But I remember residency as being a pretty happy time for me. And I was saddened by the fact that the residents were not doing well. And what really worried me is that when you finish residency, things don't necessarily automatically get better. I mean, I think we have this sort of, we look out there and we forecast that, okay, you know, we've been sort of slogging along at minimum wage for, you know, all through med school, gaining debt, and then through residency, you know, really not able to enjoy things. And then once we're able to earn a lot better income, that things are going to get better. And it doesn't always sort of match our expectations. You get out there, you start to get into your 30s, and it's not always easy. So, you know, at the time I was feeling a little burned out myself. You know, I was feeling pretty stagnant. You know, and when you're going through school, you know, I'm sort of an assignment person. You know, if somebody kind of tells me what to do, they sort of point me in a direction, and I'll, you know, they say, you know, chop wood until I tell you to stop chopping wood. I mean, that's something I'm quite good at doing. But once you have a lot of freedom to sort of pick your goals, and if you don't have a good strategy going into that, you know, you're going to end up, you know, sort of going in directions that you don't necessarily care about very much. And that's where I was. I felt like I was a mile wide and an inch deep. I really wasn't, you know, I didn't have a lot of direction. So I started reflecting on this, and the thing that I think helped me the most was a couple things. One is I started running more. You know, my wife ran a half marathon, and she said, "Hey, I really like this. Why don't you get into this?" So I started running more, and we signed up for a marathon together, and that, you know, meant a lot of training. And during training, I don't really like to listen to music, so I listened to a lot of books and podcasts. And I think one of the first books that I listened to was Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and it's a long book. I'd recommend, you know, this is sort of a classic for self-improvement and self-realization. And it really kind of hit me that, you know, that I need to spend more time thinking about strategy in my life. And I like to say when you're ready to learn, the teacher appears. And that's kind of what happened to me at that time. And I really, really started to pay a lot more attention to, you know, how I was going to live my life rather than just sort of automatically saying yes to projects and going through things like that. And so when I saw the residents were really struggling, I was also listening to a lot of audiobooks. And one of the books I listened to was a book called Extreme Ownership. And the idea in this book is pretty profound. There's this idea that you sort of accept all problems. And it's written by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, who are Navy SEALs. And they're basically talking about this. And you know, you can imagine how stressful that sort of work would be. And now they're talking about, okay, we're really going to own kind of any problem. So if they had a mission that failed, and it could be, you know, something like the weather didn't cooperate, and they would say, okay, well, we were responsible for the weather, not in a non-constructive, not in sort of a judgmental sense, but you know, we could have prepared better. You know, we there are things we could have done to be, you know, to better be able to handle that mission with all the variables taken into account. And so when I read this book, I said, you know, hey, look, I mean, I'm not going to just say, oh, the residents are sad and burned out. You know, that's not my problem. I started to say as an educator, you know, this really is my problem. I need to try to figure out how to help them.
Yeah, that's incredible. And we need more people to do things like that and kind of look altruistically at the people around them. But just kind of some points of your story that really stuck out just kind of in the beginning there. You know, you talked about setting up your own strategy for success and achieving goals instead of just chopping wood. And when I work now with whether it's our trainees or young faculty or you know, people I coach outside of the institution, that's one of our first things we work on are, what are actually your values? What are your goals? What do you want to achieve? And I think one of our biggest causes of strife, and which can lead to burnout, is not having a good sense of who we are and where we fit in. And when our sense of identity doesn't align with our department or our institution or our colleague's sense of who we are, that's when we really can see a lot of problems. And I bet you could put that framework works for a lot of issues we see in the hospital.
Yeah, for sure. And I applaud you for spending a lot of time on coaching and mentoring, because it's something that we really underuse. When we think about LeBron James, you know, these sort of high level athletes, they all, you know, they're at the top of their game. It's not like the coaching ever ends for them. They're still coaching. And, you know, in medicine, we only coach people that are struggling and need mitigation. Whereas rather than kind of looking at coaching as being something that we can sort of take us to another level or help, you know, sort of as sort of maintenance for us, where we're, you know, kind of, you know, because these are going to be long careers and, you know, we can run out of gas. You know, how do we plan for the long haul so that we can sustain ourselves?
Yeah. We talk about it a lot on this podcast, but, you know, surgeons on average, you're looking at a 30-year career, or at least that's what people are thinking when they hire us. And very few of us have coaches or good mentors who are involved in the day-to-day aspects of our lives. You know, they get involved when we have problems or when we're struggling or when we have a task we want to complete that we're struggling. But yeah, just to give us a good foundation, I agree with you completely. And I think the sports analogies hold true. The other thing you said that I really want to draw attention to was how physical health and well-being, you know, kind of the running, was maybe the start of your wellness journey or coincided well with it. And, you know, I think that's one of the things people say a lot, or one of the criticisms of this podcast and wellness movements is, listen, I'm just struggling to keep my head above water. How am I supposed to have time for my physical health and well-being? And I try to put that back or flip it on people and say, listen, when we're really struggling, our health and our physical well-being is the first thing we often let go because it's the easiest. But that really is our foundation. And if we have good physical health, if we're participating in you know, proper sleep hygiene, if we're eating well, if we're taking good care of our body physically, all of the other things actually get easier. You see, you'll have more time, you'll have more headspace, you'll have more kind of more aptitude to do the other things and get them done. So I think it's one of the common misconceptions is that, you know, physical fitness comes after wellness. And I would say it's actually the foundation.
Yeah. It's, you know, our bodies are the vessel through which we do our work. And as surgeons, if we're not paying attention to ergonomics, or we're, you know, some of the things that we do are actually fairly athletic. You know, I'm talking to a resident during a laparoscopic nephrectomy, and I say, look, this part's going to cause strain when you're lifting that kidney up. It's, you know, you're going to have to pull pretty hard, and you're going to have to do it for a while. And you know, this idea that we actually train our muscles to be able to do that. You know, I like taking, you know, little breaks during surgery. I found that as I've aged, you know, my neck and back really start to suffer. If I'm doing a 8-hour surgery, I need to take a break every hour. You know, the other thing that I found when I do this is everybody in the OR, the anesthesiologists, they're sort of astonished. They say, God, this is a really great idea. You know, you should have OSHA, you know, your OSHA should be paying attention to what you're doing here. And, you know, every hour we're, you know, kind of moving around a little bit, trying to stretch our necks out. Every 4 hours, I'm going to, you know, go relieve myself, get a glass of water, maybe even get an energy bar or something like that. I mean, I saw one of my partners when I ran down to get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And he said, "Are you done with that case?" And I said, "No, it's still going." He said, what are you doing leaving the operating room?" I said, I think the patient is okay with me taking a 10-minute break. You know, you'd rather have a fresh surgeon for the whole thing than a tired surgeon at the back half of the operation.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think there's a lot of us now who are practicing that way. I do the same thing. I try and take a break, and there's multiple benefits to that. It's a benefit to you. It gives the trainees typically some time on their own to kind of sit there and inspect a field or kind of work. And you never do it in an unsafe fashion. You're never leaving at kind of a quote unquote critical or, you know, distinct portion, right? The patient is always safe. And to your point, I think a lot of our patients now realize that, yeah, exactly like you said, you want a surgeon who's totally in when they're in there, not somebody who's worried about their back or their bladder. And lastly, I think this sets really good examples for our trainees. I ask them all the time. It's still hard to get the residents and some of the fellows to leave and go take a bathroom break, but I ask them all the time, do you have to use the bathroom? Would you like to get something to drink? It's not a sign of weakness. This is part of how we're going to take care of ourselves and take care of this patient. And if you can't take care of yourself, you know, it's like the airline analogy, right? If you don't put the mask on yourself first, you can't help anybody else. Take care of yourself and everything else will follow.
Yeah, it's creating a new culture, because I do think that there was a certain amount of suffering that it felt like you had to endure in surgery. And maybe it started with, you know, this idea that you didn't need sleep, right? You know, you should just try to be there all the time. And I hesitate to think of how many people that kind of strategy either turned off from surgery that could have been great surgeons, or burned out and flamed out of their practice early just because they weren't able to, you know, sort of live, you know, sort of endure that.
Yeah. So let's get a little bit more into extreme ownership concepts and how you bring that to surgery and medicine and, you know, the operating room.
Yeah, there's a couple of examples that I like to point to when I think of this. One was right around that time I was considering a job change. There were certain things that I was unhappy with. And once I thought, you know, really, there's not really, you know, I still like most of the aspects of the job. There were just a couple of small things. And once I wrote those few things down on paper, it was, you know, hey, my practice is big now and I'm struggling to get new patients in the door. I really need an outlet for this. And I think I need some sort of advanced practice provider to be helping me out in the clinic. The other was that I was doing a job that somebody else was getting paid for. And so that sense of unfairness was pretty strong in me. I just felt like that, you know, hey, look, why am I doing this? And when this other person is supposed to be doing it. And there was another operational detail in our division that I had a problem with. So I went to my boss and said, hey, look, here are the three things that I need. And they said, APP done. As far as the position that I was performing, they said, oh my gosh, I'm horrified by this whole thing. I didn't know this. And, you know, let's fix that. And then they also addressed the other, you know, so this idea that we sit and complain to ourselves and we don't actually write down what's really bothering us and then go to the people that are supervising us and ask them, hey, look, you know, I love this job, but here are, you know, A, B, and C, that if this was better, this would be an even better job for me than they can, you know, a lot of times I think we have a lot more power than we think to try to help impact change with those. The other thing is when there's little nuisances in your life, and I think a common one would be something like turnover time, right? For us, you know, we're not our, you know, it's not like we work until a certain time and then we go home. We work until the job's done and then we're out of there. And so turnover times can affect us. You know, we have pressure. We have this idea that we need to get back to our family life. Maybe our spouses are counting on us to help out with something and we need to try to be available to that. And so you're trying to, you know, put pressure on the staff, and rather than just, again, ruminating about it internally and just, saying this place stinks and whatever, is do a couple of small things. Things that I found pretty effective are when I'm leaving the room to go prepare the next patient, to set the expectation with the staff. Hey, let them know my circumstances. Hey, I really need to try to be out of here by a certain time today. It would be great if we could make this an outstanding turnover time. And the staff will be responsive to that. And if they're not, I'll even go so far as to say, hey, look, what can I do to help you out? If they feel like, if I can tell that they're strained and we need to be pretty sensible, or we need to be, have our antennas up when there's strain and people around us. And what can I do to help you out? And sometimes just asking them alone is going to kind of empower them to say, okay, I'm going to really try to tackle this. And then the last thing, and you probably see this, Phil, when do you, we don't see it often, but when we do see it. So think about patients that die from testis cancer. And if you reflect on, their care, what percentage of the time do you think you see, there was something that could have been done better in the care of that patient that might have prevented that outcome?
Well, that's a tough question. It's one of those amazingly challenging diseases because the vast majority of people were able to help and they do really well almost no matter what we do. And then there's that handful of people a year you lose and it absolutely rips your heart out because you look in the mirror and it's almost like you looking, back at yourself sometimes, right? Somebody with a family or starting a family. And I think it's a challenging question. I think very often there's always something we could have done differently. I think sometimes in the really advanced stages, I'm not sure how much it would absolutely impact that final outcome, but there are definitely things that keep us up at night that we could have done differently and we wish we had done differently to see if we had a shot.
Yeah. And, and I do this not just with testis, but with the other cancers we treat too, is, a lot of times we come back to, hey, it's the biology disease and we did our best, but I think this idea that we non-judgmentally take a look at what the, through the history of that, of the care of that patient, say, if I was going to point to one thing that could have been done better, this might have been it. And so that idea that, okay, yeah, we can't always control this, but, how do we do the little things that we can, this idea of extreme ownership is to try to make sure that if there was some problem in management or something where things could have been, it could have been communication. Sometimes it's, the ones that I see, it's usually a late relapse patient that probably should have had surgery. When they had a mass that was 3 centimeters, but their medical oncologist wasn't really, said, oh, they had a good response and that's fine. That's usually the patient I go, geez, man, I wish I would have gotten a hold of this patient, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no. And you bring up a great point, and I've been working on this framework and I'd love to hear your input on this, where it could be a bad outcome with a patient. It could be bad news you've received. It could be a negative interaction, but kind of the first step of it is just kind of own the emotion. Because we are emotional beings and these things hurt, whether it's a bad patient outcome or someone criticizing what we do or a complaint in clinic or whatever it may be, these things hurt. And if we try and push off those emotions, it just makes things last longer. So first thing is just own the emotion. And like you said, don't judge it, non-judgmentally, kind of own that emotion, whether it's anger, embarrassment, whatever it may be, and let it go. The second part is, the systems-based approach, right? What went wrong in this kind of care that's not related to a person that we could have done better? Was it the missed CT scan? Could we have done this a little bit earlier? Or, what could have been done better? And then the third part, which we overlook a lot in our M&M processes now and our safety and quality, is actually, what are the personal issues, right? What did that person bring to the table? Or what did I bring to the table personally that could have influenced that outcome, right? What was I thinking? What were my biases? What, did I judge that person, or did I make an error in thought because of something I kind of had innate within me? And then the last step of it is, the whole point is getting to the kind of quote unquote truth. you know, what could we have done better? And I think, you know, we're arriving at extreme ownership in different routes, but it's kind of the whole point is what's really going on in this situation? Because if we don't really take that in, we can't get better. We're just going to do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. And it's kind of the, you know, this is what our M&M conferences are supposed to accomplish. And I would say in general, they do it fairly poorly. You know, if I was going to redesign M&M, you know, you know, I want it to be a place where, you know, where, you know, if a mistake is made that more people can learn from it. Right. And that's the idea of it. But I'm not sure that in practice it's as non-judgmental. You know, there's more protectionism. And I think, you know, we're getting to second victim syndrome. Right. You know, it's, you know, with this idea that we internalize this, we want to kind of hide from this. We feel a lot of regret, whereas second victim syndrome is very real. You know, I like to tell people that I'm counseling about this. Hey, look, you know, the fact that you care so much about this is a good thing. You know, if this happened and you didn't care, you know, then I'd be a little bit worried about you as a physician. You know, I think that, you know, you have to realize that. And then a couple of tips for peer support. And this is something I really, you know, there's a doctor, I have to get his name and you can share it in your show notes, but, he's at Vanderbilt. He's a transplant surgeon, Vangerbeest, I think is his name. But he talks a lot about this, and transplant's done a good job because they see their share of poor outcomes probably a little bit more than you know, we might appreciate it as, you know, thankfully a lot of our patients do very well, but we still have those issues. But the idea of peer support, that we're there for people that are suffering and that we kind of listen in a non-judgmental way. We try to, again, have our antennas up. You know, when somebody's looking kind of sad and we know that, you know, that they maybe had a complication recently, is that we, you know, sort of just be curious about it. You know, hey, how's it going? You know, what's happening? And sometimes they'll open up to you, you know, but try to do it in private. You know, I think just making sure that people are aware when they have something like this happen to them, that, you know, you're going to be asking, you know, you try to identify it first and then try to you know, help mitigate that. And then, you know, sharing some of your own, you know, complications and challenges that you've had in the past, not in a form of one-upsmanship, but just as a form of vulnerability so that people really can, you know, understand that, hey, look, this kind of stuff happens to everybody. The fact you care is a good thing. And let's try to see what we can do to get you to heal from this and learn from it. You know, reframing is one of my favorite tools. I do a lot of prostate cancer, and there's nothing more academically uninteresting to me than putting a stent up for urosepsis. But I can tell you that I probably saved more lives putting stents up for urosepsis, certainly more immediately than by doing a radical prostatectomy. And so it's something where I try to think, you know, hey, look, you know, I went in, I did a 15-minute procedure that saved somebody's life. You know, yeah, it was annoying because it was the middle of the night, but that person, you know, they wouldn't be doing well if I wasn't around to be able to do that for them. And so, you know, this idea that we try to think about these things that are sort of not interesting to us in different ways, I think is pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to kind of highlight, you know, when you're talking with somebody about their complications and their issues, I mean, the first question is always, yeah, how's the patient? And then to your point, the second question is always, how are you? Because these things suck. They're hard and they're really tough on all of us. And building that relationship with your colleagues and your peers and letting them know that it's okay to share with me that this is not okay, you know, with you, that you don't feel good about this. That's an important part of being a good partner and a good colleague.
Yeah. So important. And, you know, I like the idea that we are, you know, that you're able to share this, because I don't think we spend enough time talking about this. I think there's a lot of people that feel like they're on islands out there and they're not maybe opening their eyes to the people that are absolutely happy to and willing to help them.
Yeah. And it brings up a, you know, kind of to come back to what you started that section with, was kind of open communication and talking, right? And tell you now, in my new leadership role, I hope I've made it clear to my staff is that, listen, if I can fix your problems, I would love to fix them. But if I don't know what they are, I can't do anything. And so often your bosses, your peers, your colleagues, they want to make your life better. They want to make your job better, but you have to tell them. And I love your idea of processing this, you know, writing it down, thinking it through. So you come up with a cogent, kind of a cogent description to your boss or whoever it may be. And I also think it's really important to start that conversation the way you did, which is, I love this job. I love this place. I love what I do, but these things are ripping out my soul, or however you want to put them, because that puts people in the, you know, in the right context that you're not trying to leave. You're not trying to badmouth them or make their life worse. You want things to get better. And these are the things you notice. And you're genuinely asking for help. And I think that's what most good leaders want to hear. And those are the positions they want to be in to help.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you know, one of the things we talk about in our burnout course is trying to come up with a personal, you know, sort of mission statement, vision, that sort of thing. And it took me a long time to realize this, but my vision is now joy serving others, right? And so I, you know, whenever I get a little frustrated with maybe a patient interaction and, you know, maybe I'm late in clinic and there's a conversation that's going on a little bit too long, I just think to myself, look, am I serving this person right now? Cause if I'm serving them, I'm, you know, accomplishing my vision. And, you know, this spirit of service, I really, you know, I want to try to promote that in the people around us. Cause it really does. And almost all cases, you know, bring me a lot of joy. Now there are certain things that I don't like doing, you know, there are certain chores around the house and whatever, you know, but there's things that I feel like I'm better at, that I can do a better job serving others. And I want to optimize that. But at the same time, you know, as in this profession, we really, if we're not enjoying that service aspect of it, then, you know, I think we need to kind of rethink, you know, how we're approaching our work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a struggle, especially when you're, because the things you do enjoy doing, the other little things can get in the way sometimes and make you forget why you're doing it. And the key is really getting down to, is it all these other little things outside that are contributing to my, we'll just say burnout at this point, but contributing to my lack of well-being? Or is it that I'm truly not happy with what I'm doing? And there's a bunch of strategies to kind of mitigate that. I think, you know, one of them is, you know, you just said it, listen, I'm not good at everything. I don't enjoy doing certain things, but we all have partners and colleagues and other people around who are really good at it. So honor those people, work well with them, you know, kind of maybe quid pro quo. What are you good at here? I'm not really good at this, but I see you are, you know, would you mind sharing this task with me? And, you know, what can I do to kind of help out on the other side? Sometimes that works well. You know, as you said, reframing works well. I don't know if you have any other thoughts.
You know, it's, you know, the, you know, I really try to help people, you know, with this idea of reframing, you know, if, especially in things like a complication, right? So, you know, how does, there's an old Chinese parable there's an old man who's wise, and a horse shows up at his house, just, you know, kind of walks out of the woods, and all the village people say, hey, you're a lucky guy. And he says, we'll see. And then his son, when he's teaching the horse, falls off it and breaks his leg, and everybody says, oh, you're unlucky. And he says, we'll see. And then there's a war, and they recruit all the young people out of the village, but his son doesn't have to go because he's got a broken leg. So I try to get people to say, look, you know, we need to be you know, on some level sort of Buddhist about these things, is that we can, I think we do need to celebrate our wins. We probably don't do that enough. You know, we say, hey, look, you know, we, our negativity bias, we need to really try to, you know, look at the things that have gone well for us and really try to celebrate those, but it's got to be tempered. You know, you don't, you know, pat yourself on the back for a year. You say, okay, this, that was great. But that could make us arrogant and it could make us a little bit too cavalier. And then maybe the next time we say, hey, that last surgery went really well, and now we're going to expand the indications. And then, you know, so that there's downsides to, you know, this idea that we, you know, that something good happened to us. Okay. Yeah. You know, maybe not. Whereas if we have a bad complication, we learn from that. And then maybe that prevents, you know, another or even worse complication in the future, because we have a lot more respect for that problem. And we learned that, okay, yeah, you're not able to do this particular thing. So, you know, I try to, hey, let's celebrate our wins, but let's put it in perspective, but also let's put our, you know, our losses in perspective too. It's like, what can we take away from that where we can bring that to, you know, to our next case and do it better.
It's a great point. I love that parable, by the way. It's such a, it does put everything into context, and it's a great story. You know, another way of putting it, and I forget the, it's a Western philosopher now, and I forget which philosopher famous. I don't think it's Kant, but kind of in that realm. But basically just says, you know, listen, our outcomes and the way our life projects, there are so many variables and so many things that go into it. To say that one behavior or one action influenced the ultimate outcome is ridiculous and kind of absurd, to think that one little thing could influence the way, you know, our life goes. And you can take a little solace in kind of that way of thinking too, is that there's so much that goes into these things, and it's important.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we, with, you know, those are all, these are cognitive distortions, right? So this is, you know, getting down to cognitive behavioral therapy. I think we need to realize when we're telling ourselves lies and, you know, hey, I'm the best. You're not the best in the world. You're not the worst in the world. Let's, you know, kind of keep, you know, you're going to have good days and bad days, and let's try to keep that real. Hey, it's March Madness. I know you love basketball.
Yeah.
How's your pool going?
I'm actually doing very well right now. I'm in two pools. I'm in first place in one of them, and I'm in fifth or sixth place in the other one, but I've still got like the max available points to me. I'm out. Kentucky hurt me. Kentucky and Baylor, that bracket hurt me, but I still have three of the four, you know, final four there. So I'm in decent shape.
Yeah. Well, I went to the University of Virginia as an undergraduate, so this is a tough year for me.
Listen, I went to Georgetown. They didn't even make the tournament this year. They lost 21 straight games. So we'll put things in perspective. There are better times and there will be good times, ahead. So.
Yeah. And you know, when I think about basketball, this is something I work on with my residents. Yeah. And, if you, and I think we don't pay enough attention to this in surgery, but if you hand a basketball to somebody that's never played basketball before and you say, hey, get this basketball into that hoop, how do they shoot the ball?
Yeah. Most people throw it underhand or something, however they can kind of loft it up there.
Or a chest pass, right?
Or a chest pass. Yeah.
Just, like, yeah. Yeah. Just kind of throw it up there, right? And then this is, you know, because I doing robotic surgery, and even any other kind of surgery too, I think we don't pay enough attention to the form, right? So in basketball, right, you got to pull your elbow in. That's not comfortable. You got to turn your wrist back. So there's little wrinkles on the back of your wrist, right? If you really want to be a good shooter, you got to be able to do those things. And so I'll take a resident and I'll get them in that shooting position. And I'll say, hey, look, does this feel comfortable? And if they've never played basketball before, they say, oh yeah, this is not comfortable. And I say, hey, this is how surgery is going to be sometimes, is you need to be able to kind of make this comfortable. So find the, you know, the comfort in that discomfort. And so things like sewing the anastomosis of a radical prostatectomy, I say, you know, you're going to have to get your wrist in some peculiar positions to be able to do this. You know, let's really, you know, look under the console while I'm doing this and see what my hand forms are, and, you know, try to work on your range of motion with your wrists. And you know, I those little tips, I think, are, you know, we probably need to be paying a little bit more attention in our learners about, you know, what exactly form are you using? You know, it's, you know, how, you know, and maybe we reflect a little bit on how we do it too, because it becomes so natural after a while. I mean, if I handed you a basketball, you just go right into that position, right? And you don't even think twice about it. We need to try to figure out how to do that with our learners too. And, you know, those little teeny tiny bits of surgery that we don't really think about very often, but they matter a lot.
Yeah. It's a great analogy. And I never thought of it that way. I mean, I think back to, you know, I play basketball every week now, at least once a week, kind of a regular pickup game. And I love basketball. I'm not great, but you know, and I can shoot a basketball and my form's pretty decent. It's one of the few things I have going for me. But I think back now at the thousands and thousands of repetitions of basically L to I, right? That's what you teach your kids. You know, mm-hmm. It's what I work with my girls on now. And I've never once said to them, you know, this is going to be uncomfortable. I understand that this is going to be uncomfortable for you, because I've never even processed it that way. But you're right. It is uncomfortable when you first start doing that. And only through repetition and practice does it become more comfortable. And it makes me think of I've never been a huge fan of robotic simulation and kind of practice. I feel like, you know, the only way to learn an operation is to do an operation, but I've always had the thought that you can't play chess unless you know what the pieces do, right? And so that's the reason to simulate it. So you learn the pedals and the hand motions and other stuff, but this, you're opening my mind here, Paul, about, you know, kind of getting people into odd hand and body positions that are not odd, but they're odd the first, you know, however many dozen times you do them, to make them understand that the ergonomics of this are strange and you're going to have to learn how to move your body and get different body awareness and different feedback to do this. That's really thoughtful, Paul.
Yeah. Well, and you know, just cause I can't contain myself anymore about this, but I think that something that helped my instrument handling more than anything else is Brett Sheridan is he was a cardiothoracic fellow when I was a resident. And when I was a second year resident, he handed me a chest tube clamp on the floors. And he said, I want you to carry this around for the next 6 months in both hands, open it, close it, twirl it around, do whatever you want to with this thing. Just, you know, when you're just walking in the hallways, you know, carry this instrument. So now if I have a low level resident that I'm seeing is just struggling, you know, with instrument handling a little bit, I don't tell the hospital I do this, but I'll sneak back into the peel packed area and I'll find him a nice heavy, like a ring forcep or something like that, and hand it to him and say, hey, look, I want you to now return this when you're done with it, but I want you to walk around with this thing the next couple of months. And I want you to be known as the guy that clicks, because you're twirling this thing around, you're clicking it and you're opening it and you're closing it and doing this, and do it with both hands so that you're able to handle the instrument. And it's, for me, I thought it was really valuable to just, you know, try to, you know, just make that instrument feel totally natural in my hands without even having to think about it.
I agree with you. I did the same thing in my residency. I had a pair of needle drivers, and some of that was just, you never knew when you were going to have to, you needed a pair of needle drivers, and tracking them down was going to be challenging. But yeah, you just have them in your pocket and you click through them and you get more used to holding things without looking at them, especially when your pocket's obscuring the view too. And it brings me back to another great sports analogy. So in a former life, I was a catcher too, in baseball, and at higher levels, you really have to work on your framing. And so I would just bring a tennis ball around with me, and I was instructed to do so. It wasn't my own, you know, thought, but bring a tennis ball around and just all day long as you're walking, just bounce it and frame the ball as it kind of picks up to kind of keep it in the strike zone. So you just work on soft hands and moving the ball around and getting used to kind of that stuff. And it's another great sports analogy, is just kind of making the less familiar familiar by doing it in all the time, you know, just making it very common and seeing it around. It's another great point, Paul.
Yeah. It's, you know, when I think about our learners, you know, how we can make them better, you know, it's just keeping that patience. How can we, you know, sort of optimize the time with them? You know, I there's a lot of regrets I have when I think about how I could have been a better teacher, but you know, I don't know, we can always improve.
Yeah. So tell us, I mean, you obviously are a great teacher. The residents at Colorado love you. Tell us a little bit about kind of your process, whether you want to get into philosophy here or nuts and bolts, some of the other things you may work with them on.
So, a couple of things. One is I try to tell them, you know, you don't come out of the womb knowing how to do this stuff. And I have to think this to myself too, you know, things that for you or me were, seem pretty natural really are not, you know, we don't automatically know how to do these things. We've had hundreds or thousands of reps and they may not have, and how can we get them those reps in the safest possible environment? You know, in robotic surgery, I will tell you that probably single-handedly has pushed more people out of academic medicine. You're trying to teach robotic surgery is probably single-handedly pushed more people out of academic medicine. But what I try to remember is look at your, you know, and usually it's the speed, right? You know, you're watching, you're like, oh my God, how am I, you know, I need to be just patience. I have certain mantras that I'll go through. I mean, you know, I'll do the Lord's Prayer or something else just because I need something to kind of take my mind off of it while I'm watching them a little bit. But if you've I'm sure made presentations with video of your own robotic surgery, what is your impression of your operative speed when you go back and watch your old videos?
Oh yeah. I mean, you're always slower than you think you are.
Oh, every time.
Every time.
Every time. And so it's this whole idea of this notion of time to us is really weird, because you're like, oh my God, even if you just rewound the video and watched it, you said it did not at all feel that slow when I was actually doing it. And so I try to remember that when I'm watching the residents is we have this time bias that when we're actually doing it, I don't know if there's certain processing power that just sort of makes the time feel a little bit differently to us. But when we're observing, it's very different. So I try to keep that in mind. And then if you're not embarrassed by, you know, some of your old work, you're probably not learning. So, you know, and then, you know, if you're a learner, if you're a teacher, go back and watch your videos from, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and it'll feel really, really slow. And so this idea that we got to reframe that how we teach, right, is that, you know, this time bias is real, you know, don't be so impatient with them. And then, you know, try to find those little things that'll kind of help you get through, like, you know, lean your head out of the console for a couple of seconds, blink a couple of times and put your head back in. And then, you know, I try to think of learners, and I do this with my, you know, with, you know, not just my residents, but, you know, advice for, you know, teaching kids and things like that. I love growth mindset, right? You know, this idea that we're dynamic vessels that, you know, we're going to learn, you know, we're not either all good or all bad. You know, we don't want to sort of identify as traits. You know, it was basically a situational thing, and, you know, we could be a different person tomorrow. But I think of learning as these kind of dynamic concentric circles where in the middle is your comfort zone. Those are the things that you're good at and you know how to do. So if I have a chief resident and they're my focuses are going to be very, very different with them because their comfort zone is a lot bigger than my junior residents will be. And I feel like I can put, you know, when they're in their comfort zone, now the pressure is efficiency, right? I want them to be faster. Okay. So, you know, now, okay, you know how to do this. You've got tons of reps. Now we're going to be working on speed. Outside of the comfort zone is your learning zone. Okay. That's the one where we're looking more at technique. So we're going to be, I can't put the speed pressure on them. I have to just have them be focusing on technique. And then outside of the learning zone is the panic zone, right? This is, you know, this is as if I say, hey, do this RPLND. I'm going to go to my office. I mean, the things that we just never do anymore, but, you know, it's like we would, you know, we just can't, you know, have them in the panic zone. Or, you know, if we're saying, oh yeah, you know, do this when, you know, functionally, I know they're unable to handle it yet. But what I want to do is I want those circles always growing, right? And so I want those, you know, that panic zone to get smaller. I want the comfort zone and the learning zone to get bigger. And so we do different things. And it could be, you know, my junior residents, I'm, you know, their comfort zone might be just draping the patient. And I'll say after, you know, they get to about halfway through the year, I'm going to, for a ureteroscopy, for instance, right? So I'm going to say, okay, our intention right now is to is to how fast can you get the scope in after this patient is intubated? Okay. I'm just going to sit back. I'm not going to do anything. This relies on, you know, you communicating with the people around you, try to figure out how to do this efficiently. But if I teach you how to do this quicker, I am probably saving days of your life over your career. You know, if you can shave this down from 10 minutes down to 5 minutes, that will, you know, you're going to be home sooner. You're going to have a lot more time in the long run, and, you know, you're going to appreciate it. And so those kind of things I like to, you know, try to focus on is that, where am I putting pressure? Is the focus on efficiency, or is the focus on technique? And, you know, I just, and then the same thing, the last thing I'll say on this, I'm kind of going, you know, going off here right now. I'm sorry for that, but the last thing I'll, say on this is that we have certain preferences, right? But we don't have randomized trials for those preferences. Okay. So we don't know that, you know, we may have something and we're like, well, like I would do that probably a little bit differently. I think we have to temper that a little bit to say, is it within the range of acceptability? Because they're learning right now. And I do this with my children too. Like, I don't want to correct every single thing that they're doing wrong. If I know they're not going to get hurt, it's okay. All right. If they're not hurting somebody else, then it's okay. Cause I don't have a randomized trial to say that, you know, the way that I like to do it is the only way to do it. So I try to say, is this in the range of safe acceptability? And if it is, let them keep going. Okay. Maybe a little slower, but if they're learning, then that's what I want them to do, because, you know, sometimes the learning is in the struggle, right? You know, they're going to find that, like, that wasn't really efficient the way that I did it. I might say something afterwards, like, yeah, if you would have done this way, it probably would have been a little bit more efficient, but, you know, it was safe. And so, you know, I try to keep that in mind. I try not to correct every single thing because I want them to struggle a little bit.
Yeah, that's great. And, I love hearing you talk about this, Paul. You and I are so similar in the way we approach things, and it's always interesting to pick up on other people's tips and tricks. And the first thing, kind of in a summation, I just want to say, I mean, what you're really describing is an intentional practice of teaching, and it benefits the learner and it benefits you and gives you both kind of the correct, you know, mindset to kind of be an effective learner and an effective teacher. You're really addressing what they need and you're addressing what you need. And just kind of some specifics there, you know, you talked about the time bias. It's fascinating to me that surgeons are almost exactly, the time bias is 50%, almost exactly. We always think we're 50% faster than we are. It always ends up taking us 50% longer than we would have thought. Just next time you're in a room and you hear one of your colleagues say, oh, I'm going to be done in 30 minutes, poke the nurse in the back and say, watch, 45 minutes. And you're almost exactly spot on. It's phenomenal the way our mind works in that 50% bias. Couple of things I do in the operating room, just to piggyback, and I'm definitely going to take in some of the things you just said. I really like the idea of functionally thinking about the growth mindset and what that resident needs at the moment. One of the things I do with robotic surgery is I get my head out of the console and I try not to watch them through the console, because it just makes me want to put my hands on the clutch and go. So I get my head out of the console. I'll watch on a different screen to kind of give some feedback or watch. I use a 5-minute timer. So we take turns, 5-minute intervals. And the rule is always, if you are where I think I would have been in 5 minutes or a reasonable error, I'll give you another 5 minutes and we keep going. And what that does is it keeps the case moving. It keeps things efficient, but it also forces them to make moves. They can't just sit there and pet tissues or guess, because they know they're going to have this step of the operation no matter how long it takes. And I think that the time interval and the time pushing is actually a really important part of being a surgeon. And I hate the mantra that, you know, there's no such thing as a good slow surgeon. That's not true at all. A safe surgeon is a good surgeon. But there are certainly times, particularly I tell people, if you're interested in oncology and you're interested in big cases, there are times where somebody's life is going to depend not only on you being good, but being good and fast. The only way to get good and fast is to practice being faster when somebody's life isn't on the line. So, you know, with a junior resident, I would say, listen, you're closing skin. You do a great job of closing skin. Do it faster, right? if you screw it up here, you cut out the suture and you redo their skin again. But I want you to work on getting faster. Get that instrument, get those sutures, move as fast as you can, push yourself, because this is an opportunity to get better. And I think it's the same thing you were saying, where draping, getting the camera in, getting the ports in, these are all opportunities to be better and faster. And it's not that speed is the goal, but it's efficiency and thought process and all of the other parts of it.
Yeah, no, there's and this is another basketball, you know, John Wooden, right?
Sure.
Quick, but don't hurry, right? You know, yeah. So that's one of his old quotes, which is one of my favorite in surgery. You know, if you're being hasty and you reach for an instrument, you drop it, you know, some of those instruments, it'll take 5 minutes to replace that thing. So, you know, quick, but don't hurry. Right. And so you want to, there's times to be, you know, or quickly, so slowly. That's when I first learned it from Paul Balling. He's a burn surgeon. When I was a second year resident, he said, you know, quickly, slowly. You know, I think is good advice in surgery every time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're getting close to our hour here, Paul. I just want to give you the opportunity, if there's things you want to talk about or questions you want to ask before we wrap up.
Yeah, I want to, you know, if there's urologists listening out there that are going to the AUA, please come to our AUA course. I do this will be our now fourth year doing the course. Ryan Terlecki, from Wake Forest, and Amanda North from Montfiore. You know, it's Ryan and I just, you know, when we started this course, we kind of just, you know, said, hey, what do we want to do for a course? And the AUA accepted our burnout application. We said, oh, shoot, now we got to find somebody that actually knows what they're doing. And so we brought Amanda North on, and it's been really fun to do and really well received. And so if there's a urologist out there that are interested in coming to our course, I'd encourage them to do so.
Yeah, I've in full disclosure, never attended your course, but I think I've seen just about every part of the course through some form of lecture or meeting or other part. And it really is fascinating content, fascinating interaction. So I would make the same encouragement to people out there. So on that, we'll just kind of summarize our talk for the day, Paul. And I want to thank you again for taking the time to kind of chat with me. There are definitely some amazing tips and tricks here and just kind of a general approach that I think a lot of surgeons are going to benefit from. One of the things I really appreciated for is your thoughtful approach to teaching. And a lot of times we talk about how to make teaching better for the learner, but I think you really given us some really good insights in how to make teaching more effective for us, how to be good teachers and how to really help them out. And that was very much appreciated by me today. And I'm sure other people. So just as we kind of went through the hour, we talked about setting goals for ourselves and really kind of defining those things. We talked about setting a good base of physical health and well-being, whether that's through physical exercise or diet or sleep. We talked a bunch about extreme ownership and really taking, and reflecting on the things we're going through. And part of that reflecting is effective communication. So not only understanding what we want to take ownership of, but communicating those issues to the people around us, whether it's our boss, whether it's our operating room team and turnover, as you brought up that example. Really effective communication is part of that ownership model. We talked about all of the good ways to teach, the growth mindset, but I thought my favorite thing that you said today was, joy in caring or serving for others. And I think that's a really great example and a vision or a mission statement that a lot of us can aspire. It's not only serving other people, that's why we got into medicine, but it's really having joy while doing that and imparting that joy onto the others who are around us. So thanks again, Paul. Awesome hour. Awesome chatting with you. Look forward to seeing you in person, definitely in New Orleans.
All right, Phil, this was so much fun. I feel so humbled to be a part of this. What you've done here has been really amazing. And every episode comes out, I'm first on the list for listening to it.
Well, great. Well, not possible without great people like you, great colleagues and friends. So keep sharing the message and spreading the good news, and we'll all get better.
Yeah, you take care.
All right, Paul.